This is Ann Larrabee, and I'm with Matt Barkowiak, and we are interviewing Bill Ayers. And Matt, we'll start with the first question.
All right, thanks. First question, in Fugitive Days, you write about the psychological, sometimes almost cultish dimensions of being in the Weathermen. Looking back, would you say that now the process involving things like the gut check, weather fries, etc., what would you say about that process that led up to the violence in terms of the dynamics of the group?
You know, I don't think that the psychological aspects led up to the violence, and I'd even want to unpack the question of how violent was the weather underground. I mean, what would I even call it violence? Certainly, that's the label that's been hung on that experience, but I'm not sure I'd go along with that. I think what led up to the extreme measures that we took were not psychological primarily. Were not primarily understandable as either social or psychological, but really were profoundly political choices we were making. Look, let's go back a bit. I was first arrested opposing the war in Vietnam in 1965. That was when the United States took its first giant step into that event. That's when the war started for the United States. There were 39 of us arrested at the Ann Arbor campus. We were surrounded by thousands of students who opposed what we were doing. So one of the great myths of the 60s is the idea that this was somehow popular. Overwhelming majority of the American people supported the adventure in Vietnam in 1965. Now, 3 years later, 1968, that had completely turned around. Now, about 65 or 70% of the American people opposed the war in Vietnam. And we could talk about why that happened in 3 years. But the important thing in terms of your question is that by 1968, when most people were opposed to the war in Vietnam and most people thought it would end fairly rapidly, the war escalated. Nixon was elected, Kissinger had a secret plan, and the war not only escalated but loomed ahead of us indefinitely. And every day that the war went on, 2,000 innocent people were murdered. We were trying to figure out what to do. I mean, I was a young kid from a very privileged background, fallen into this work kind of by accident. I mean, a certain amount of choice making, obviously, and a certain amount of chance making. But there I was, and 3 years of being a full-time anti-war activist had yielded real results. But now the war wouldn't end. And as we looked forward, we had no idea that it would go on for 7 more years or 20 more years. Who knew? So the question was what to do. And the movement splintered on that question, and the anti-war movement splintered as the civil rights movement splintered. But for some of us, we felt, and you can read the rhetoric of the time and see a kind of excessiveness, a kind of exaggeration. But I felt personally that we had to do more, that we couldn't allow 2,000 people to be killed every day and not escalate the resistance. Now, some of my friends joined the Democratic Party. Others of my friends and family ran away from the United States and lived in Canada or Europe. Others organized the industrial working class. Others went to California and built tree houses. We built an underground, and we wanted to, number one, take the war to the war makers, and number two, we wanted to make a revolution. Seems extravagant today, but that's really what we thought we were able to do.
What you're calling extreme activities, others have called symbolic violence. And I'm fascinated by the term symbolic violence. And I'm wondering if you agree with that term, and if you do, if you could unpack it for me a little bit. Because I'm not entirely sure of the definition of symbolic violence.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've ever used the term symbolic violence. But I would say this, that if you look at the continuum of activities that, say, for example, I was involved in opposition to the war and in support of Third World Revolution, in support of black human rights. If you look at the activities I was involved in, it included everything from writing editorials, petitioning my government, writing letters to congressmen and the editor, sitting in at draft boards, sitting in at government buildings, picketing, being involved in mass mobilizations, throwing stones at windows, you know, in Washington, D.C., in the midst of large protests, burning the American flag as a symbol of militarism and oppression in that moment. So I was involved in a lot of things, and I felt very strongly that there were other things that we ought to be able to do that would not tie us up in kind of self-defense postures, where we had to have legal committees and we had to organize, you know, fundraisers for our lawyers and so on. But I thought we ought to be able to survive a kind of escalating attack on the war machine. And so, for example, before we went underground, we did many things like disable airplanes at air bases in California that were destined to go to Southeast Asia and drop bombs on Southeast Asian people. And so, was it a violent act to knock out the landing gear of an airplane waiting to rain death on Southeast Asia? I think not. I think it was a nonviolent act, in the same sense that the Berrigan brothers hammering on silos in Nebraska that house nuclear weapons is an act of militant nonviolence. And so, in a sense, we called what we did, I've never heard the term exactly symbolic violence, but we called it armed propaganda, or propaganda of the deed. And to unpack that a little bit, what we meant was we were trying to communicate. So what were we trying to communicate? We were trying to communicate that right here, inside the United States, inside the center of empire, was a group of young people who were so profoundly dissatisfied with the direction of this country that we were willing to risk our lives, we were willing to risk our freedom, to try to put a little dent in their capacity to wage war and to conquer the world. That was one thing we were trying to communicate. And the second thing we were trying to communicate, which comes through in all the communiques we wrote, is we were trying to say, and you can't catch us. Because we felt very strongly, as incidentally I feel today, that the script of the people who rule the world is to say, we're impenetrable, we can't be beaten, this is all inevitable, everything that's before you is inevitable, it's the end of history, and so on. And we wanted to say, not only is it not inevitable, it's not likely. Not only is another world possible, another world is coming, and you don't know it, but it's true. And so that's what we're trying to communicate with our actions. And if you look at the record, we killed no one. We injured no one. The three people in the townhouse, that was the totality of our casualties. And that was a catastrophe, and it was a day when a greater catastrophe might have happened. But that's exactly what we did. And in the meantime, we caused maybe a few million dollars worth of damage in a country that was causing millions upon millions and life upon life in Southeast Asia and elsewhere. We felt like we were restrained.
Interesting. Now, in terms of the way that individual identity was formed within the Weather Underground, looking back, do you think that any part of the, and again, I mean, just to use the word with, you know, quotation marks around it, but the revolutionary violence, was it in some way existential? Was it potentially, you know, to a degree narcissistic as a part of a quest for personal identity? And then actually, I think we talked about this a little bit, you know, on the other hand, was it also a manifestation of just pure spectacle? Within a way. So, you know, kind of wondering about the way that individual identity versus group identity might be formed within the group.
You know, I'm not sure that I have a complete handle on where you're going, so I'm happy to kind of bounce it back and forth. I think there's a great difference between saying, was it narcissistic, was it existential? I think, of course, it had an existential dimension. I feel like I came of age in the age of existentialism, and whether one called oneself an existentialist or not, you couldn't but be affected by the idea that your life was a project, and that what you did with your life, how it manifested itself in the actual world, was how you came to life. And did I feel that? I think, of course, I felt that. I felt that, and frankly, I still feel. I felt then that I was a work in progress. I still feel I'm a work in progress. I felt then that I could say, I am what I am not yet. I feel like I could still say that. I don't feel like I've completed anything. I feel like everything I did is prelude to what is going to happen tomorrow. So in that sense, Yes, I think it had a profoundly existential feel to it. Did it feel narcissistic? I don't think so much, although, you know, the last person to ask if he's a narcissist is Narcissus. I mean, you know, I mean, how would he know? So sure, I mean, I think there's a way in which there's a self-centeredness that we all, a subjectivity that we all carry around. But no, I felt we were looking outward profoundly. We were not navel-gazing. We were not looking into the mirror of our own brilliance and saying, aren't we great? I think we were riddled with doubt. I think we were riddled with a sense of incompleteness. I think we often, in those 10 years, went back and forth between feeling like, we've done a lot, and, oh my God, we haven't done anything. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I still feel that. I still feel, what have we done? I mean, here we are in an historic moment that almost couldn't be described. Surely couldn't have been described 5 years ago, but there are no terms to describe how extreme that I think we've come in this country. And what am I doing about it? Not enough.
In Fugitive Days, you seem to be looking back and trying to make sense of your own past and your own evolution. And I was wondering why you chose the stories that you did about your American boyhood. For example, making the zip gun and those sorts of things. Why did you choose the stories that you did of all the stories you could have told?
Well, you know, I mean, tell me the stories you're interested in. I'll tell you about the zip gun. You know, the reason that I did that little prelude, I mean, the book really is framed around 10 years. The year is 1965 to 75, the exact years of the American War against Vietnam. And that decade for me, and I didn't know this until I tried to write it, that decade for me, that 10-year period, is split down the middle by the death of Diana Outen and my other two friends. So that became the shape of the book. And then I put a little prelude on and a little afterword on to try to kind of create a context in which those 10 years make sense. The main reason for the prelude was to cop to something that is so obvious, and I ooze with it even today, is that I came from a very comfortable upbringing. I came from a world of unspeakable privilege. And of course, like other people who have privileges, wasn't aware of them. I mean, how would I know? This was the way a 15-year-old lived, or a 10-year-old, or an 8-year-old. I lived my life, right? But I was thrust into a world of enormous privilege and comfort. And like most people who are living that kind of life, I was anesthetized by it. I was blinded by it. Not only could I not see my own privileges, I couldn't see the world. And so I wanted to give a little bit of sense of what it was to sleep the deep American sleep. And frankly, I think the country is sleeping the deep American sleep right now. And it's a tragic sleep. So I wanted to give a little sense of that. And at the same time, I wanted to give a little foreshadowing of the goofball who was to emerge from that, me. And the foreshadowing included the 4th of July, which is a big part of every, you know, middle-class American kid's childhood. And by now, I mean, we're all... We're no longer as innocent as we once were. And so we know Frederick Douglass's 4th of July speech, and we know, you know, what the 4th of July has meant to others. But at the time, it's a very symbolic part of an American childhood. And for me, it took place at a lake. And on that lake, there were great firework displays. And the fact that, you know, virtually every year someone was injured kind of went without mention. So I thought it was a little foreshadowing of what was to come, but also very much a piece of the story of this anesthetized, hypnotized childhood that I did live.
Yeah, and you talk a lot about living under the shadow of the atomic bomb, right? And so why was that an important part of that early?
That was important for a couple of reasons. Again, because I was born in 1944. So I was born in the atomic age. And I think for the graduate students who are with us today, for people who are older than me, there's a different experience. But for my generation, coming of age in the shadow of the atomic bomb was huge. So for example, I was one of the kids who was taught to duck under my school desk if there was a big flash. We were to get under our school desk. And I remember, you know, I mean, and it's so absurd, and I tried to write it absurdly, that, you know, that we were to cover ourselves with a towel, perhaps, and then when it was all over, we were to wash thoroughly. What the hell are they talking about? You know, yeah, exactly, exactly. So it seems so absurd in retrospect, but that's the world I lived in. So one of the points I'm trying to make there, I dug up Harry Truman's speech about the atomic bomb, and it's filled with the same kind of reckless, narcissistic, maddening kind of rhetoric about, thank God that he gave us the atomic bomb because we'll only use it well, and the great master understood that we, of all the peoples on earth, needed this technology so that we could obliterate the heathens. And I mean, what is he talking about? And it's in the form of a prayer, you know? So I dug that up, and I remember vividly that sense of entitlement, that sense that we could do no wrong. It also happens that my father was the chairman of Commonwealth Edison, the owner of the largest nuclear power grid in the country. And if you would, and as I grew up and understood more and challenged my father, you know, he would say things like, well, technology will solve the problems of what we're going to do with the waste. And it was that faith, that kind of blind, insane American faith in itself. That's what I wanted to portray.
But when Terry's looking at the Blaster's Handbook, is he having the same kind of faith?
I think so. And I think that that's the point that I make. I mean, I think that I make the point, I try very hard to make the point. I mean, the book is written in a style and in a form. It's a memoir, remember. It's not a manifesto. It's not a political program. It's not an ideological statement. It is a memoir. And because it's a memoir, what I try to do is to both say what it felt like to be there then. In other words, I take the main requirement of memoir to set a character down in motion, in a moment, and let that person make judgments without the benefit of hindsight. But the narrator has to be wise enough so that when I chant Ho 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 Chi Minh, I'm not actually chanting it, I'm looking with a little maturity at that. On the other hand, I want very much not to be one of these old middle-aged people standing on the ramparts of middle age and looking down at the fields of youth and saying, you idiots, because I don't feel that way about it. I feel like I did the best I could with what I had. And frankly, the impulse, the desire, the hope that we could create a world of justice, a world of peace, that hope seems to me as sparkling and real today as it ever did. Now, do I think we're going to get there? You know, I don't know, but I almost called my memoir In Our Lifetime, because I always used to sign my letters in our lifetime, meaning we were going to have a revolution in our lifetime. I was 20 when I started doing that. I'm now 60. But I still feel that way. I still feel that I want to live a life of opposition, that I want to live with the possibility that we can create a just society, a reasonably fair and decent society. And I don't think it's as far away as people imagine. I don't think the edifice that this society is built on is as strong as the projections from the Bush White House want us to believe.
Well, you're looking forward, but the opening scene, that Diane, is about looking backward. It's almost a traumatic moment.
Well, I begin with Diana because that is the incident that splits the decade in half for me. And the first half of that decade is waking up from Lake Forest Academy, from the, you know, the soft and squishy privileged 50s, waking up to a world in flames. And as I wake up, I decide I have to be an activist. I have to live in opposition. And it's those little choices for the first 5 years of that decade, an escalating sense of responsibility. And then Diana dies, and the next 5 years are trying to pick up the pieces and create something that also is hopeful and forward-looking, but it's a correction. I mean, 1970 was a catastrophe for me, for us, and there were kind of two choices. We faced a fork in the road. We could pursue what led us to the townhouse, or we could try to make sense of it, pick ourselves up, and do something that, while it may seem unreasonable to you, at least seemed survivable to us. And so that's the second 5 years. And that's why I begin with Diana, because, again, as a memoir, I wanted to take the reader into the middle of things. I didn't want to have a tedious, expository, you know, didactic, here's, then I did this, then I did this. I wanted you to be right in the middle of Diana dying and know that that's what was framing the book, was the death of my friend.
Interesting, yeah. And I guess kind of in terms of picking up the pieces, I guess, again, kind of coming back to the idea of group identity within the Weathermen, how did the collective thinking, especially in that time period after the explosion, drive the group to its breaking point? Not in terms of only the use of explosives, but also, say, as it mentioned in Bringing the War Home by Jeremy Varon, the brief endorsement of figures like Charles Manson.
There was no endorsement of Manson. That's a myth. That's an absolute myth. I don't know. Did I write about that? I don't think I did.
I don't think you did. No, not in Future Days.
I've written about it, but it didn't make it into the book. But, you know, the Manson myth is on a parallel track with the myth that when GIs came home, they were spit upon. Nothing is further from the truth. It may have happened once, but there's actually been books written about the fact that it didn't happen. And yet I've met military men today who are sure they were spit on back then, and I just don't think it's true. What Bernadine actually said in the midst of the craziness of Flint was, we're already painted as lunatics. She said, we got on an airplane in Chicago, and everybody looked frightened and had to move away from us. And she said, and here we are in a society that's killing black people, that's murdering Vietnamese at this horrific rate. And what's on the front pages of every paper? This goofball, I mean, this lunatic who, you know, murdered these people and stabbed them with a fork, you know, dig it. So that it was not as unreasonable as it sounds. Kind of like Ward Churchill. I mean, you may think that it was a stupid thing to say, but it wasn't the way it's portrayed, as if we were following Charles Manson. Nothing could be further from the truth. He was a racist and a murderer, but we were following Ho Chi Minh, and you may not like him either, but we thought of ourselves very much in the tradition. Now, you're interested in this kind of question of collective thinking. I think that in a group like this, or any group, but a group under this kind of stress, you do develop a kind of collective thinking. And frankly, I think it's true in your family. I mean, you all have family lore, a way of talking, a certain number of jokes. You have it among your close group of friends. In our case, because we were under the kinds of pressures we were under, because we were forced inwardly, we were subject to a kind of groupthink. But I do think after 1970, we broke from it. Mm-hmm. And I think that it lasted for a period. It was problematic. And I think we broke from it in its extreme. Does it still exist among leftists? Yes. Among right-wingers? Yes. Among other political people? It does. And among most social groups. You develop a series of internal jokes. But as you know from reading the book, I feel like in my own life, I mean, I'm allergic to that kind of dogmatic cult-like thinking. And I think I'm allergic to it because I took the live virus and survived. I think that it's very hard for me to even hear somebody say, oh, you ought to try this Montessori school because Maria Montessori thinks. I immediately can hear Ho 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 Chi Minh chanting in my head and I want to run for the railing. But having said that, I also think it's important that people come together and do look at the world collectively. How do you do that? How do you balance the strengths of the group, the strengths of collectivity, with a skepticism about it? I don't know that I know, or I don't know what the rules are, but I think that's a good exercise. What's the difference between a community and a cult? My little brother lives in Oak Park, Illinois, and he has these two daughters, my nieces, who are wonderful. And I was out there for Halloween, and I said, why aren't you guys trick-or-treating a couple years ago? And they said, Uncle Bill, it's Oak Park. We can't trick-or-treat until 3. And I looked at my brother and I said, this is a community or a cult? What is this? You know, the Oak Park cult. We trick-or-treat from 3 to 7. I mean, yeah. But that's probably a sensible rule for the children of Oak Park. But it struck me as funny because I'm allergic to groupthink.
I was reading Philip Caputo's A Rumor of War and was just really struck by the processes that you describe versus what he describes and sure. how it seems very, I mean, in terms similar. So,
well, without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, I think that what you end up doing in, you know, when you're building a cult is you not only escalate the kind of personalities of the leader and so on, and you diminish the agency of ordinary people, but you break down their humanity. And I think that's what basic training is in the military. It's the breaking down of your humanity so that you can do things that you wouldn't do as a normal person. You, Matt, would not go into a house, kick down the door, intimidate the children, and drag the women out by their hair. You wouldn't do it. But if you were in Iraq today, you would do it. And that's a frightening thing. That's what groupthink does.
Excellent.
I was just going to say that, to follow up on this, that one thing that worries me about groups is secret activities, that groups that turn to these kinds of activities get too narrow, that they're not transparent enough, that they don't have enough reality checks. You know, that might be the definition of going underground, and I'm just wondering if you might comment on that.
I don't think it's the definition of going underground, but I think it is. A component part of creating a cult that's airtight, and I write about that. I mean, I try to write quite a bit about what it feels like to be in an airtight container. And so that chapter that begins, the summer was dank and the collectives dark, and you know, we huddled down and prepared for war. I mean, I try to be honest about that, but I don't think it's a feature of going underground. When we were underground, just as the people in the French Resistance would say, and I've read, you know, René Char and others have said, when we were underground in the French Resistance, we were never freer. And in a sense, the first 5 years of being underground, I was never freer. I was free to think. I was free to work in the shipyards and have many, many friends who were really ordinary people. I was free to test my ideas against a lot of people outside of the movement, outside of SDS. So it was not in and of itself the experience of going underground. But I think it is true that, and I'm not even sure that secret activities are always the thing, although look at the behavior of fraternity and sorority people on a campus like this. The things that they do keep secret, and frankly, it's true not just in an organized way, it's true among groups of friends, and it's true within families. The things that you won't speak are the things that you should worry about, without a doubt. So as I said before, I think the difficult thing is that there's nothing in terms of gearing up to fight the state, there's nothing in terms of going underground that in itself creates a cult-like or a groupthink that's impenetrable. But those are two possibilities. I think there are many, many other examples in the normal course of events. And I would also say that the thing you have to worry about is that on the one hand, there's the problem of groupthink and the activities of the collective. And on the other hand, you should worry about the illusion of splendid isolation. It's me. I have a mind of my own. You know, I quote from Monty Python, The Life of Brian, where the reluctant Messiah is on the ramparts and he's saying, I'm not the Messiah. And they say, you're not the Messiah. And he said, no, you have minds of your own. And they say, we have minds of our own. And at that point, somebody says, funny, I don't feel I have a mind of my own. And they smack him and say, you have a mind of your own. Now think about this country right now. And think about what anybody thought about Saddam Hussein 5 years ago or 15 years ago. Wasn't on anybody's radar. My mother said to me in 1991, I was taking care of her, and she said, now I know you kids hate war, but you have to admit, this one's worked out well. And of course, I catapulted through the ceiling. And she said, well, you must admit Saddam Hussein is a maniac. And I said, is that your independent evaluation? Did you come to that through your own independent investigation? No, she was told that, and we're all told that, and now we all genuflect in front of that totem. Well, now watch as we turn our eye on Iran, and now Iran will be something that right now, nobody in this room could draw a map of Iran. And yet that's going to become now the focus of all of the attention, and we're going to all not follow along, but too many of us are going to exceed our own brains to the powers that be. That's groupthink of the worst type.